Port of Portland and developers have announced that although they are interested in building crude oil rail terminals, they aren't yet ready to move forward. The Port of Portland released a statement saying they would not move forward with any plans to build a crude oil terminal until environmental safety issues are addressed. The ports are currently fitted to receive crude oil from ocean faring vessels. Martha Richmond, a port spokesman, said the agency has received a number of proposals to build the terminals. She refused to give details, claiming there is a confidentiality agreement between the ports and the companies hoping to land the lucrative contracts. There have been at least 10 oil car derailments since 2008, causing massive amounts of environmental damage. The Port of Portland claims that until the transportation of crude oil by rail has a sufficient accident-free record for a sustained period of time, it will not move forward with the secret plans to build crude oil rail terminals.
Mile-long trains carrying volatile crude oil from North Dakota started showing up in communities in northwestern Oregon without the public's consent. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality signed off on an air pollution permit change in June 2012. This allowed an ethanol fuel plant near Clatskanie to start moving crude oil from trains onto barges bound for West Coast oil refineries. There was no debate and no public hearing, as 100 car trains just started to show up and block intersections in towns like Scappoose, Clatskanie, St. Helens, and Rainier. Steve Massey, a Rainier city councilman, stated that he and other city officials didn't know that they were hauling volatile crude oil. DEQ regulators claim that the Columbia Pacific biorefinery needs to involve the public and must get a permit to unload crude oil. The facility has allegedly violated state environmental rules by moving 297 million gallons of oil between December 2012 and November 2013. The DEQ permit allowed the Columbia Pacific biorefinery to move 50 million gallons of crude oil. The company operating the plant, Massachusetts-based Global Partners LP, faces a maximum of $25,000 fine for each day it operated out of compliance. The Global Partners LP is contesting the violation.
On Monday, the first day to apply for a medical marijuana license in Oregon, 289 internet applications were received in spite of the $4,000 fee. Nearly 200 applications were received within the first hour. Dispensaries cannot be within 1,000 feet of each other, and within 1,000 feet of many schools.
A bill to distribute funds from class action lawsuits in Oregon has been delayed after pressure from Republican legislators on behalf of the British Petroleum Oil Company. Several Oregon Republicans have proposed a substitute bill which would exempt the oil giant BP from being liable for the class action payouts. Republicans are pushing the Oregon legislature to complete the session by Friday of this week so they can attend a conference. And House Bill 41-3 looks like one of the many bills that will be left by the wayside and not brought to a vote. Currently, if a corporation loses a suit, any unclaimed damage awards go back to the company. Under House Bill 4143, those unclaimed damages would go to Oregon Legal Aid, which provides legal help to low-income residents. The House passed the bill but faced obstacles from Republicans in the Oregon Senate, who are calling for an exemption for BP. The oil company lost a class action lawsuit in Oregon on January 31, 2014. In that case, the jury found that BP-owned gas station ARCO and AMPM overcharged consumers in the state of Oregon. The jury found that BP recklessly violated the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Nearly 3 million class members are each entitled to make claims for $200. Stopping the legislation in Salem this week will allow BP to get out of paying a large portion of the $600 million settlement here in Oregon.
At the request of several Oregon congressmen, the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, will audit the Cover Oregon website as part of a wider investigation of state-based health insurance exchange projects. The congressmen, including Senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden, and U.S. Representative Greg Walden, requested that the GAO examine issues such as how federal funds were spent and whether the federal government provided adequate oversight. Cover Oregon remains the only health insurance site in the country that does not allow the public to self-enroll. GAO spokesman Charles Young said that the exact scope of what will be covered in the investigation, as well as the time frame, are yet to be determined.
One way to lower health care costs is to keep people healthier to begin with. Care Oregon, which administers Medicare and Medicaid in the state, says that means looking beyond what happens in the doctor's office and improving how people live and interact. It has four teams that include Care Oregon members, all of whom are working on pilot programs to be used in local communities. KBOO's Susan Cecil has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
The first community innovations pilot is underway in a couple of Portland neighborhoods. The goal of Give to Get is to reduce social isolation among people with chronic health conditions. An informal network of neighbors willing to help each other, from raking leaves and giving haircuts to checking in on older people. Rose Enlert with Care Oregon says the feedback so far is that participants like the combination of handy services and a sense of community.
We've heard that people, for the first time in a long time, have felt that they have value in their community, particularly folks who maybe have disabilities or aren't working for some reason. We've also been hearing that people have enjoyed meeting their neighbors.
She says the Community and Innovation's goal is to look at members' concerns that end up affecting their health. These concerns include housing situations and food insecurity. Four teams are each developing different ideas with input from Care Oregon members. Enlert says the proposals range from assisting people with managing their medications to helping healthcare providers spot and fight hunger among their low-income patients.
We all know that ultimately a very small percentage of our overall health is what happens in a provider office. And while that's incredibly important, we're very interested in assisting people in that overall well-being and collaborating with members.
For KBOO News, I'm Susan Cecil.
In the budget he released yesterday, President Obama included a proposal to extend the earned income tax credit to cover more young workers who are struggling to live independently from their parents. The proposed extension of benefits to childless workers, including those under 25, is a departure from the usual focus on help for families. Current age restrictions prevent workers younger than 25 from claiming the childless worker benefit.
The Oregon House today approved a bill that allows cities and counties to ban medical marijuana dispensaries until May 1, 2015. The bill gives local governments until May 1st of this year to enact bans on the dispensaries. If local governments choose not to ban dispensaries, the bill allows them to regulate them, including setting hours and zoning restrictions. Currently, 21 Oregon cities have passed legislation banning medical marijuana facilities. Another 14 cities, most recently the town of Beaverton, have imposed temporary bans that extend up to a year. The House bill, which passed by a vote of 51-6, now heads to the Senate for approval. The Senate passed a version of the bill last month that would not have allowed outright bans, but would have allowed other regulations. If the bill passes the Senate, the legislature still has the option to decide on new laws if Oregon voters approve a measure to legalize marijuana in the November election.
Multnomah County stands to lose $2 million in a failed software development contract with a Colorado company. According to the County Attorney's Office, Customware Incorporated, or CCI, was hired in 2009 to replace the software platform used by Multnomah County Department of Assessing, Records, and Taxation. Despite seven extensions on their contract, CCI was unable to develop the software on schedule. When the company informed Multnomah County officials in May 2013 that they would stop working on the project if they did not receive more money, the county refused and the contract was later terminated. In July of last year, CCI filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The company owed over $10 million in liabilities to 200 creditors. In tomorrow's March 6th Multnomah County Board of Commissioner meeting, the county is expected to authorize the county attorney to initiate a lawsuit against CCI for damages. The Multnomah County attorney says it's unlikely that taxpayers will recover any of the $2 million invested in the now bankrupt software firm.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an interview with a Venezuelan professor about the situation in that country after this newscast, followed by Occupy Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rainy and windy, high of 52, wind south-southwest at 20 to 30 miles per hour, rainfall around a quarter of an inch. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 31 counts per minute in North Portland. Powell Butte measures 28 CPM. In Vancouver, Washington, the radiation count is 23 CPM. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 26 counts per minute. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information on radiation counts, including the meaning of counts per minute, can be found at radcast.org.
It is 5:15, time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Never let it be said that the uber-rich bankers of Wall Street are too uptight to get down. A recent article by reporter Kevin Roos reveals that some 200 of the elitist financial tycoons turn into party animals at least once a year. The occasion is the annual black tie induction ceremony of Kappa Beta Phi, a secret Wall Street fraternity dating back to the 1929 crash that caused the Great Depression. Roos waltzed right into the St. Regis Hotel ballroom a couple of years ago to behold the madcap event. Top dogs from J.P. Morgan Chase, BlackRock, Citigroup, AIG, and other Goliaths were munching on foie gras and laughing uproariously at silly skits, bad musical parodies, and dirty jokes performed by 21 younger Wall Streeters being initiated into the billionaire's frat group. Adding to the gaiety, the inductees had to dress in drag, wearing wigs and gold sequin gowns. The banker's idea of hilarity included sexist and homophobic jokes about Hillary Clinton and Representative Barney Frank. Also, a hedge fund honcho dressed in ragamuffin tie-dyed clothes to represent the 99%, and various songs bragged about the bailout Wall Street got from sad sack taxpayers. As Roos put it, the whole evening amounted to a gigantic middle finger to Main Street. The irony is that these are the pampered titans of finance who have lately been wailing that they should get more respect from the general public. One of the chief whiners has been billionaire speculator Wilbur Ross, who's complained that the 1% is being picked on for political reasons. This is Jim Hightower saying, picked on? The word you're looking for, sir, is saved. But rather than offering a thank you, Ross was the grand swipe of Kappa Beta Phi who presided over the gala, mocking the very public that saved the whole pathetic bunch of Wall Street narcissists.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Seven Democrats in the U.S. Senate joined Republicans today to block the nomination of Debo Adegbele to head the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. The vote was 47 in favor and 52 against. Majority Leader Harry Reid voted aye, but then switched his vote for what he called procedural reasons. The main point of contention was that Adegbele once worked for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Doing his job as a lawyer for that organization, he succeeded in getting the death sentence of black nationalist Mumia Abu-Jamal commuted. Abu-Jamal's sentence was changed to life imprisonment due to the work of Adegbele and other lawyers. The Fraternal Order of Police, Fox News, and criticism from Pennsylvania Republican Senator Pat Toomey and Democrat Bob Casey has helped fuel the drama around the nomination, according to Mumia's supporters. President Obama called the decision, quote, a travesty based on wildly unfair character attacks against a good and qualified public servant. Obama blamed Washington politics for derailing the nominee based solely on his legal representation of a defendant. He said that criticizing a lawyer for doing his job runs contrary to a fundamental principle of our system of justice. Mumia Abu-Jamal is an internationally acclaimed intellectual who has done his work from a Pennsylvania prison cell for over 33 years. 30 of those years were spent in solitary confinement on death row. His weekly worldwide radio broadcasts and best-selling books have been translated into 9 languages. For more, we go to an interview conducted by Janka Soderbergh with filmmaker Steven Vittoria, who produced the new film Mumia, Long Distance Revolutionary.
Mumia's name has come up after President Obama nominated Debo Adegbele to lead the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department, with the critics of Mumia saying that nominee has been involved in his case and therefore should not be in the U.S. Justice Department. I wonder if you can comment on that most recent public relations or most recent appearance of Mumia in the national media.
Sure. Well, that entire backlash was as moronic as you explained it. I guess what the other side wants us to believe, you know, they supposedly believe in the Constitution and they believe in America so much that when a lawyer works on a case, which is the bedrock of the so-called American judicial system, apparently in Mumia's case, they didn't believe he deserved to have lawyers from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, or anybody else for that matter, work on his case. I mean, it's an utterly moronic argument, and I know that Mumia and I were just laughing about it. He finds a lot of this comical, believe it or not. He never takes it personally, and he knows that he knows it's just another way for folks to either, you know, try to slam another pile of dirt on Mumia or in their ongoing attack with Barack Obama. There's loads of things to attack Barack Obama about. The fact that this dude was one of Mumia's backroom attorneys during the appeal portion of Mumia's case is absolutely ludicrous, and you know, they just basically, like I said, want us to believe that some defendants in this country did not deserve a fair trial, did not deserve competent representation, and you know, but they're allowed to get away with it on Fox News. They bring the other clowns out of the box, and they'll say anything. And it isn't even borderline racism. It's just out and out racism. You know, instead of calling Barack Obama what they really want to call him, they attack him in these ways, and it's laughable and sad at the same time.
And the district attorney for Philadelphia, Seth Williams, says in his response to this nomination by President Obama that, of course, in our system, even a radical cop killer, Mumia Abu-Jamal, is entitled to legal representation. That does not mean, however, that those lawyers who elect to arm him in his efforts are suitable to lead this nation's highest law enforcement offices. Not usual language for a district attorney, but obviously there are strong feelings in this case.
Yeah, there are, and I love when people call Mumia radical, because frankly, I don't find Mumia radical at all. Who I find radical are people that can lob cruise missiles into neighborhoods, people that can go on and commit economic rape, people that are psychopathic racists that are actually in power. That's radical thought. Mumia is talking about peace. He's talking about feeding people. He's talking about educating people. He's talking about putting people to work. I don't know. That seems pretty peaceful and straightforward to me. It doesn't seem very radical. You know, they've managed the great John Pilger, the great journalist, is always talking about how the power structure makes the unthinkable normal. And that's ultimately what they've done in this country and in other countries. They've made the unthinkable normal, where war is normal and peace is abnormal, where people without health care is normal, and people with, you know, it's an ongoing problem. And Mumia is anything but radical, and he is a revolutionary for sure. But he's not radical. The things he stands for are what we all should be standing for.
Well, thank you so much. Stephen Vittoria, the filmmaker, the writer and director and editor of Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mumia Abu-Jamal. Thanks so much for joining us today, Stephen Vittoria.
Thanks, Janky, for all your hard work.
Tensions ran high at a brief House Oversight Committee hearing today when California Representative and Committee Chairman Daryl Issa adjourned abruptly without letting other members of the committee participate. One of those who was not allowed to speak was the frustrated Elijah Cummings. Issa recalled former Internal Revenue Service Chief Lois Lerner to testify about the process used to grant nonprofit status to political groups. Lerner consistently invoked her Fifth Amendment rights and declined to answer ISIS questions, just as she did when she was questioned in the summer of 2013. Here's a clip of that exchange at the committee hearing today.
Mr. Chairman, you cannot run a committee like this. You just cannot do this. This is, we're better than that as a country. We're better than that as a committee. I have asked for a few minutes. May I ask my question? May I state my statement?
You're all free to leave. We've adjourned, but the gentleman may ask his question.
Thank you very much. For the past year, the central Republican accusation in this investigation.
We're adjourned. Close it down.
I am a member of the Congress of the United States of America. I am tired of this. We have members over here, each who represents 700,000 people. You cannot just have a one-sided investigation. There is absolutely something wrong with that, and it is absolutely un-American.
Hear, hear.
KABU reporter Robin Ryan spoke with Common Cause about the heated exchange and the investigation into whether or not the IRS focused its scrutiny on conservative nonprofit groups.
How would you characterize the exchange between Representatives Issa and Cummings, and do you believe that kind of banter is constructive to serving the purposes of a democratically governed public?
Well, I think it was an incredibly tense and testy exchange, and clearly passion are very high over this issue, which is very important. There's been a record number of comments to the IRS and the Treasury Department on their recently proposed rules and regulations governing the political activities of 501c4 social welfare nonprofits. Unfortunately, there have been a handful of political operatives that have set up sham 501c4 nonprofits to spend money in politics from anonymous donors to the tune of well over $270 million in the 2012 election. And of course, that led to a huge increase in the number of applications to the IRS, and the IRS admitted that it used inappropriate criteria in trying to screen out which groups were legitimate social welfare nonprofits and which weren't. And that's what this morning's hearing was going to start to tackle, although the IRS official, Lois Lerner, decided to invoke her Fifth Amendment rights to not testify. Congressman Issa, who has really been aggressive in his claims and in his investigation, called the hearing off after about 20 minutes without allowing anyone on the Democratic side of the aisle from participating, which clearly disappointed Congressman Cummings, the ranking member, who wanted to at least be able to speak at the hearing. Congressman Issa directed staff to turn his microphone off, which really just led to the kind of argument that we saw break out this morning.
Congressman Issa seems to make the argument that conservative nonprofits are scrutinized disproportionately. But the data that I've seen from the Center for Responsive Politics suggests the bulk of those contributions, which, by the way, jumped from $5 million to $300 million in just 6 years, are coming, by and large, from conservative nonprofits.
All right. I mean, I completely agree that it's no surprise that a number of conservative groups were flagged, given that 85% of the money came in from conservative-aligned nonprofits.
Specifically, Representative Issa inquired about the Karl Rove-run Super PAC Crossroads, and I know other advocacy groups have taken legal action to prevent this group from claiming status as a social welfare organization. What formula is currently in play that might limit what these groups can spend to influence the electoral process?
The law says they have to be exclusively operated to further the social welfare. The IRS has interpreted that to mean they must be primarily engaged in doing social welfare activities, and the regs say intervening in political campaigns does not constitute social welfare. Well, the fact that it says social welfare organizations must be primarily engaged in social welfare has led to a number of lawyers to say, primary means a majority of your time, which means 51%. So you see these organizations claiming that they're now allowed under the rules to spend basically half of their time and resources, 49% of their time and resources, on hardcore political ads. So you've seen Karl Rove set up a super PAC, which is called American Crossroads, they can do as much political activity as they want because they disclose their donors. But you also have an arm of American Crossroads, another entity, a sister organization called Crossroads GPS, which is running a lot of the exact same ads, but is claiming that it is a social welfare organization and is primarily engaged in social welfare activities and only spends a minority percent of its time and resources on political ads, which amounted to over $70 million. We think it's clear, and a number of other watchdog organizations have filed complaints with the FEC because they think that Karl Rove, Crossroads GPS, is anything but a social welfare organization and is primarily organized to defeat Democrats and elect Republicans to office. And to be clear, these kind of entities exist on the Democratic side of the aisle as well.
I've been talking with Stephen Spaulding, staff counsel at Common Cause. If you'd like more information about the work that they do, visit their website at commoncause.org.
And now
this is Robin Ryan.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, March 5th, 2014. A Palestinian man found dead in his home near Hebron City, and settlers storm Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian young man was found killed in Al-Fawar refugee camp near the southern West Bank city of Hebron on Wednesday. Local sources said that 20-year-old Firas al-Balisi was found dead inside his home in the refugee camp. The Palestinian police was called in to investigate. The police announced that the body of the young man was moved to the Abu Dis Institute for Forensic Medicine to determine the cause of death. Also in Hebron, the Israeli army on Wednesday abducted two people, including a minor, in addition to a youth from Jerusalem area, according to local sources. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have set up flying military checkpoints in several neighborhoods in the city of Hebron and at the entrance of several towns and villages, stopping cars and checking the driver's identity cards, causing traffic jam. Elsewhere on Wednesday, dozens of Israeli settlers, accompanied by Israeli police, have again stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, touring the facility while holding maps and documentations. Local sources said that two groups of settlers raided the mosque through Bab al-Mughrabi Gate while they were holding maps and brochures. Palestinian worshippers and students who were at the mosque started chanting slogans to protest the settlers' actions, the sources added. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, March 5th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
Tensions continue to be high in the Ukraine, where a truce negotiated today has brought a stand down of the Russian troops that entered the region on Monday. Ian Masters of Background Briefing has more analysis on the issue.
And I'm speaking with Catherine Stoner, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for International Studies, deputy director of the Center for Democratic Development and the Rule of Law, as well as faculty director of the Ford Dorsey Program in International Policy Studies at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, and Local Heroes, the Political Economy of Russian Regional Governance. So if he's cynical, then does he believe that there are Nazis running amok in Kiev with a swastika armband. I mean, a lot of people have been repeating that. I've been getting a lot of mail saying that this is all the Nazis and the anti-Semites are all behind that. I mean, there are a couple of right-wing parties, Right Sector and Svoboda, Freedom Party. I believe they have there are some nationalists. I think four posts in the government from Svoboda, even though its leader, who's been accused of anti-Semitism, is not in the government. And I believe somebody on the National Security Council has a deputy, who Dmytro Yarosh, who's the head of the far-right paramilitary group called Right Sector. So is there any substance to these claims?
You know, not really, despite what you just said. I think if you have demonstrations with hundreds of thousands of people in them, then you get all kinds of crazies who come to the party. And so that, you know, was there that dimension in a very, very small way on the streets of Kiev and Euromaidan? Yes, but that's not what the movement was about at all. And that was not the message at all. And, you know, I think Mr. Putin is partly selling that line for a domestic audience to revive in the memories of Russian citizens in Russia, you know, the threat of the Second World War and the memories of Russians with respect to the Second World War was very, very long. They obviously lost millions and millions of people. So that's one issue. The second is, you know, he's right, trying to create this sense of an external threat, and that you know, it is up to him and to Russia to save Ukraine from this external threat. So on the one hand, it's fascistic, but on the other hand, it's also the United States getting involved somehow. There's just simply no evidence of any of this. You know, just like you know, he's trumping up the accusation that ethnic Russians were being threatened in Crimea. Well, there's no evidence of that. The only people who've died so far in the last week and a half, are ethnic Ukrainians. Viktor Yanukovych, his security agencies, shot 70 of them.
Right, but Putin said that they were shot by right-wing provocateurs.
Well, he said they were shot by snipers. Yes, we're not clear who hired the snipers, but he's suggesting that Yanukovych didn't. Right. But at the same time, here's another contradiction in the news conference. At the same time, he's saying that Yanukovych withdrew his security too quickly from the square and ran away. And he warned him not to do that, he said, in this press conference. And so as a result, Yanukovych has lost his country.
But he's also saying that those troops without insignias that have taken over Crimea are not Russian. I mean, there was a confrontation between the Ukrainian soldiers who were unarmed, who marched up to the Russians, these people without insignias who fired over their heads. There have been efforts on the part of pro-Russian thugs to stop the press and the wives and mothers of some of their besieged Ukrainian soldiers from delivering food and parcels, etc. So that's, to me, that's where the volatility is, isn't it? I mean, what's your sense of whether or not this volatile situation could be sparked by some misunderstanding or bad move?
Sure. So that is a real danger. And I think there are different, you know, the fact is there are different groups. So on the one hand, we have some political tourists or you know, demonstrator tourists who have either taken it upon themselves to go from Russia into Ukraine to participate in whatever happens. On the other hand, we have some who are definitely paid by Russia to go and stir things up. On the third hand, what Mr. Putin was suggesting, and this is just not credible, that the men in green, as they're called in Ukraine, these soldiers without insignia, are somehow local militias. The only way in which they could be local militias is that they've come from the Black Sea Fleet base that Russia has there. That's that's how they're local. There's no doubt that they're Russian. We've had different officials tell us they're Russian. And then they're also traveling in vehicles with the black license plate of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. No doubt there. Yes, I think there is a real danger, though, that some either Russian militia or regular army from the Navy, from the Black Sea Fleet, or a Ukrainian soldier fires accidentally or on purpose. In fact, we had some firing over the heads of Ukrainian soldiers today. That could actually spark a real conflict, and I think that's really the danger, and partly perhaps why he was reminding, the audience that Ukrainians are our brothers in arms, and that these soldiers will be fighting on the same side of the barricades as the Ukrainian soldiers.
Well, Catherine Stoner, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Catherine Stone, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for International Studies, deputy director at the Center for Democratic Development and the Rule of Law, as well as faculty director of the Ford Dorsey Program in International Policy Studies at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, and Local Heroes, the Political Economy of Russian Regional Governance. We're going to take a brief station break and be back.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Mario Haro, Desiree Garcia, Ken Jones, Aaron J. Bernard, Ann Fleming, and Robin Ryan. Special thanks to reporter Susan Cecil. Our engineer in the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty talks about the Portland police targeting black hip-hop performers and Right to Dream 2. At 9 o'clock, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Per Fogreen hosts Fight the Empire. He'll focus on escalating crises in Ukraine. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, on Between the Covers, local illustrator Chelsea Stephen and photographer and writer Patrick Dixon discuss the Fisher Poets Anthology, Anchored in Deep Water, a 7-book set featuring over 35 poets. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Portland author Stephen Hanks discusses his book, The Aki Tree, A Portland to Africa Search for Family. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you're not a member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the death of former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Supporters of Chavez and his socialist successor Nicolas Maduro marked the occasion with a parade, while anti-government demonstrators continued to take to the streets to express their displeasure with Chavismo, the name given to Venezuela's unique brand of socialism. Inadequate security, economic scarcity, and alienating foreign policies are at the top of demonstrators' complaint lists. But many Venezuelans insist that Chavismo has dramatically improved the lives of women and the poor. KBOO reporter Aaron J. Bernard spoke with Dr. Sandra Angelari, professor of anthropology at Universidad Central de Venezuela, about the situation on the streets of Venezuela and the battle for the country's social, political, and spiritual future.
To get started, can you talk about what's happening on the street in Venezuela today?
I live in a sort of high-class neighborhood, so we have barricades in the house where we cannot go outside or enter, but there is no people there. So that's one part here where the mayors of the city belong to opposition party. That's what happened. In the rest of the city, today is 1 year of the death of President Chavez. So you had a huge parade of popular power, as we call here the civil society, but it's not exactly the civil society, it's a different concept. And you have also many presidents from the Caribbean and from Latin America and from other countries who came. So at this moment, we have a mass, we call it ecumenic mass. So you have Jewish, Catholic, Protestant, kind of indigenous, all different religions, and there's a huge mass for the body of President Chavez. So that's what is going on. But anyway, a different question is, what are we expecting? So we don't know what is going to happen, because they're like violent events in the rich areas of the city. And so in the night, we are always waiting for that. That's it.
Is the foreign media's representation of what is happening in Venezuela accurate?
Well, in Venezuela, we have all the TV channels of all around, like cable, you can. So we perfectly know how what is going on in Venezuela is represented. So we know it's represented that there is a dictator. And what is happening is that this movement that they began the 12th of February, and they represent themselves as students, and true, many of them are students. According to the numbers of the people who were detained, there are like 40%. But the other 60% are people from different social origins, but mainly they are high class people, or there have been also some detainees who are what the police system international calls them terrorists, that they have detained me. Or today, for example, I didn't see it, but I heard by the TV that there were 12 attempts of, exploiting tunnels. Or if you see also to the border states where you have opposition governors, it's very violent. But one of the situation in the border is that because all economics of Venezuela they have a support of the state, so the products of Venezuela are in a contraband towards Colombia. And so there is also an economical reason of the border to be against the economical politics. Of a new law that was the day before all the violence began, that is called just prices in the plural, that allows only a 30% of earnings for those who are selling products. So there is a huge problem for buying and for consumption, but one of the reasons, not the only one, is because the Venezuelan products are going outside borders because they are very low prices. For example, something that here is cost of 30 in Colombia can be 400. So that's a problem when the government wants to subsidize products here. So it's very complex situation in political terms, in social terms, and economical terms.
Does Venezuela have a participatory democracy right now under Maduro?
Well, Venezuela has changed its constitution in 1998, and one of the main changes was that in addition to be a representative democracy, now it's named a participatory democracy. That means that it's a huge promotion of everyday people from the grassroots to organize themselves in order to participate in, like, not in legislation of the country. So, for example, I'm in the women's movement. I participated in the change of the work law, but from the perspective of women, or any other law. So this is the legislative order, but you can also participate in any kind of instead of having a central government, the promotion of the law, what is called here the people's power. And instead of only those who are in the government to represent you, they call it a state government. So they are going to the local and the small city and to the neighborhood. So there is a huge participation of the poor people who before they were never even having an ID or they were not centered of the patient. So in the last 15 days, this movement won 18 electoral processes. The last one was the 8th of December, where 76 of the people voted and 66% of the people voted for the Chavista proposal. So after that, instead of doing like we always did before, that we never won, and the role was to wait and win an election. So they are making this violence, and so the problem is that the government of Venezuela can be defined as a failed state. If the international community defines Venezuela as a failed state, there is a conviction that it can be an intervention from outside because of the non-control situation of the country. So it's a very dangerous game. It's promoting a civil war between those who think that the other people need to wait for the election and to win an election. But it's not fair that if you don't win, then you become violent. You have to respect the rules of the game. But we perfectly know that that's not the story that is told outside Venezuela. Because usually the people who are the poor people, they don't have access to the corporation media, as we call them here. Although we look at them in our TVs, no?
You have said that you want an eco-socialist feminist revolution for Venezuela. What would that look like?
Oh, that's because I belong, for example, to a movement that is ecological. And one of our more recent participations, for giving you an example, we call it the seed law. So we realize that we need not to depend on importing seed or importing food for the cattle or importing fruit. So in a country that is mining and is oil producer or gold producer, or Venezuela is a mining country, ecology is difficult. And we think that 21st century socialism needs to articulate ecology and socialism. And the other point is about feminism. We always have women he had the support of President Chavez, that he identified himself as a feminist, and in Venezuela as an historical process, then we participate a lot in the grassroots movement. But that doesn't mean we have the higher positions in political terms. So at this moment, we had the recognition in the Constitution, for example, that women's work at home is part of the national product of the country. So that's one of the main points. The second main point that we already had, and it's because of the support that Chavez gave to us, is the support, like in the U.S. it's called like care for poor people, but in this case it's a support to the women who are mothers and who don't have, who are poor. In this case, what happened, because of the traditional structure of Venezuelan families, usually women are alone with children. And so this is a huge change for women that now are the greatest number in what we call the mission. The mission are parallel systems of the government, not to fail into bureaucracy and to do things through executive power, through parallel organizations. So women are the majority studying, we are the majority in the community council, we are the majority doing the work. But the struggle now, for example, how we call the Ministry of Defense, who is now a woman, and it will never be thought about. We could have never think about it before, to have a woman that is the chief of the army, of the national army of the country. So feminism, we are struggling as always, but we had like a Chavez push up, no? So that, and in the law systems and in the positions we have within the government, as always, there is the danger that if you're a woman, it's because you support the political work of men. But little by little, things are changing.
Is there anything else you'd want to add about the situation in Venezuela right now?
Yeah. I think that in historical terms, the way I read things that are going on here is we are feeling a spiritual revolution. We are feeling the poor people are now in the power. The poor people belong to the government. You, as a poor people, you can enter anywhere. You can enter to a police station, a radio station. You have access to the university. The number of university students changed from 500,000 to 2.5 million. So it has been a change. It's very, not only in the people who are in power, but what happens is we are changing the way we used to say, we are changing the building while we are inside the building. And that's not easy.
And you're listening to KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland 90.7, and we will have more analysis on the situation in Venezuela at 7 o'clock on Hard Knock Radio, so be sure to stay tuned in for that. But right now, we bring you Occupy Portland Radio with host Jimmy Tardy right after these messages.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the PDX Fusion Winter Event, Words. Words will take place Saturday, March 8th at 8:30 p.m. at the Analog Cafe, 720 Southeast Hawthorne. PDX Fusion celebrates the collaboration between different modalities of expression. Words will feature multiple different performers, visual and interactive art, and a short presentation on creating social change through body-centered communication. That's Words, hosted by PDX Fusion, on Saturday, March 8th at the Analog Cafe. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is sponsoring an evening on the future of schooling in Portland at the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, March 13th. It starts at 6 p.m. with a panel discussion that addresses what's ahead for public schools after the recent fierce contract battle, the case against high-stakes testing in privatizing schools, why public schools produce higher test score performances than private schools, and how we can work together to create truly wonderful schools. Speakers include Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Teachers Union, also school board member Steve Buell, and folks from the High School Student Union and Oregon Save Our Schools, a parent group. After discussion, we will present the film The Inconvenient Truth About Waiting for Superman. It's a film that debunks the attack on public education and teachers' unions. It all happens on Thursday, March 13th at the Clinton Street Theater at 6 p.m.
We are one woman.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 in Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or radiocab.net.
It's about time.
Welcome to Occupy Portland Radio Special Edition for March 5th, 2014. I'm Jimmy Tardy, and I am an occupant. I am not an occupier. I am an occupant. This is my home, and I am responsible for what happens here. On our show tonight, we start off with a tribute to Hayseed, a member of the End the Camping Ban vigil at Portland City Hall, and an interview that I conducted with him last summer right after he received some acknowledgement from Willamette Week regarding his efforts at being a good citizen. We also talk with Becky Looning about the Guantanamo inmate situation and local and international solidarity fasting efforts. We'll hear from some of the people who were at the Keystone XL protest held a couple of weeks ago in front of the federal building by Terry Shrunk Plaza. And we'll also hear some music and some words of wisdom that were pulled from the documentary called Bicycle Dreams. But we've got a lot to get to, so let's do it.
Coffee every morning and candles at night. Let's see. I guess... okay, I'll leave that in there. Let's see. You move it across the street to the sidewalk he now sweeps. During the Occupy movement. You know, I mean, started sweeping. You know, I would have to, I like claiming, yeah, I would have to get rid of all of that. I don't mind having the word Occupy in there. I'll leave the two occupies in there. Occupy, occupy. So occupy, occupy. Tossed. I should have left tossed in there. Occupy tossed. Yeah. Leave the tossed in there because I'm for Occupy Pizza nationwide. Oh, oh, God. Oh, geez. What? Joe stands outside City Hall talking to people about their problems. Yes, but I have hours, certain hours. Sometimes I'm off the clock. He listens and he gives them stamped and addressed postcards so they can send their complaints to the governor. No, they're addressed to City Hall. Hey, Joe comes back bringing his broom and fresh cups of coffee. Well, I can let that ride, I guess. Sure. Oh, my golly. Well, yeah. Let's just do the interview that I didn't do with the...
I'm here at Chapman Square, and I am sitting and talking with Hayseed. And we're talking about the Willamette Week's Best Of for July 24, 2013. Mentioned second in the article is Hayseed in regard to his efforts at City Hall.
Yes, the vigil to end the camping ban at City Hall.
Yes, his efforts associated with that. While he's, I'm sure, pleased at the recognition and all that, and he's nodding his head as I'm saying this, it does have a few things to say about some of the factual items in the piece.
Well, may I just preface this by mentioning a few days ago before I saw this that to a friend that about a gal from Willamette Week who was wanting to interview me, I sent messages that I don't do interviews, and I was saying, telling Dan that, hey, you know, like, let's say we go down and defeat it. Maybe it appears like that today, except for that we're holding court over here in the park.
Defeated due to the sweep from the sidewalk that just happened by the mayor.
Right. And so we look back years later, and the one bright spot is old Joe, who used to sweep the sidewalks. And then, lo and behold, here a couple days later is, yes, isn't that sweet? But since then, you know, I have not swept any sidewalks. I moved over here and I did sweep the sidewalks and the street, and just sort of like getting it ready for a community effort that would